not all of our companies have succeeded. In every case that I can think back on, in every case, it's not been the technology, it's been the management. You have to have three things. You have to have management, you have to have technology, and you have to have money. Usually, if the management is right, you can get the money when there's good technology behind it. It's a three-legged stool. Any one of those three, it doesn't work out, this stool is falling down. In every one of the cases, it's always been the management was not right. We have with us today Kimani Isaac, and Kimani got her undergraduate degree from Northwestern University, and then she is now working at Salesforce, but she is also planning to join the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School in May of 2026. And with her current job in Salesforce, she's looking at she's a value service engineer, which means she does analysis of return on investment. She's covering the healthcare industry, medical devices, automotive, manufacturing, energy, and utilities for Fortune 500 companies, which is a lot. But part of her MBA, she'll also be doing a master's in international studies. And she's looking at sustainability and finance around this. And she wanted to interview me to ask some questions about how we bring our technologies to market. And the other thing that she has been attending my group meeting, actually, through Zoom, just to learn more about that. And so she's been doing that for the last, a couple of months, something like that. So I'm going to just turn it over to Kimani to ask any questions that she might have. And she sent me the list of questions, but I never read them. I just thought that I saw that they were extensive. So I said, well, if we're going to do this, why don't we just record it? Because maybe it'll be a blessing to others. So go ahead, Kimani.
Well, thank you for making the time and for having me here, and also for allowing me to attend the lab meetings. It's been really lovely because I've been following your research since 2021. So being able to follow from afar and see how the work has grown and evolved, and then also now be able to have this conversation and see how your lab runs has just been an honor. So thank you. So this conversation specifically is because I want to gain context around how the lab has come to be where it is and the decision-making behind the commercial paths that have been and are being pursued. So the goal of this part of my research and laying the foundation for the thesis that I'll be doing in grad school is to essentially see where the circularity of industrial materials is also going to shift the magnitude of economic flows more broadly between actors within industrial supply chains and in our society. So, after joining the lab meetings these past few months and having conversations with some of your former students and current students, it's clear that you run the lab in ways that really prepare students particularly well to enter the private sector. And you train them to pursue not only scientific exploration, but also economic viability in their research. And I'm curious, what experience actually shaped you to run the lab this way?
It was not with intent. I think it just evolved this way. And so I started as an assistant professor at the age of 28. I had no experience in running companies or doing things like that. Although as a postdoc at Stanford, I did have an idea, and I went to it was very early on in the time at Stanford that they had their tech transfer office. And I do remember getting a disclosure form from them so that I could begin to reference my idea. But maybe a year or two after I started my career, I started to file patent disclosures and then patent applications. And started to think that hey, maybe we could capitalize on some of this. And for the first many years, until 2014, actually, we used to license a lot of the technologies to companies. And then it was sort of out of our hands to big companies. And I found out that by doing that, you make very little money. You could get a little bit through what the university makes, but there was no real if there was a banner carrier at the big company, they got transferred out after a while, and the intellectual property just kind of languished there. Nothing really big happened. And there was no liquidity event. So in other words, there was no big event where I could make real money. I just, something small on the licensing fee and some small royalty or something that would flow through the university, and then I would get a fraction of that and the students would get a fraction of that. But then in 2014, I was approached by an investor, and he said he wanted to start a company around graphene quantum dots, a paper that we had published. And I said, sure, let's go ahead and do this. And a few months after that, he and I got together, and he came with one of his associates, and he said, well, maybe do you have other companies too? I said, actually, do you have other technologies too? I said, yeah, we have something in computer memory. They said, oh, we like computer memory. Let's start a company around that. And so it started like that. And those first few companies, I mean, I wasn't having students go into them. They would learn the technology, and these investors would start the company, hire the CEO and do the board. And I was never an officer or director in those companies. Now, I should backtrack a little bit that in 1999, I did start a company with four other professors, and it didn't go well. I mean, it was very easy to raise money in 1999, 2000. It was the dot-com boom, and really, really quickly you could raise money. And but we were trying to make molecular electronic memory that would have no moving parts, yet non-volatile memory. And at the time, all there was on that was magnetic hard drives. We didn't know that flash memory was coming down the line. And so flash took off, and our company was no more, because that was electronic memory that had no moving parts. But I also learned everything what I should not do. Because in that first company, I was on the board and all sorts of, and I realized I cannot be a professor and run a company at the same time. You'll do both poorly. And so when we started these other companies in 2015, so that was 15 years later, I was never an officer, director on the board. I didn't have to worry about conflict of interest, and I could just strictly be a professor. I didn't want to be a businessman. I didn't want to have to cater to all of these investors all the time and things like that. And so we started starting these companies. And then I think the students also changed. The students started to have more of an entrepreneurial interest. Prior to that, they all wanted to go into big companies, you know, work for Intel, work for Merck, and have a steady paycheck and a steady job and something like this. And certainly some students, that's what they still want. But then they realized that, hey, you could do much better if you were with one of these startup companies, because what happens is you can have a liquidity event, either taking it public or the sale of the company or something like that, and you start having an earning potential which is much higher. Yes, it is higher risk, but these quote-unquote steady jobs with big companies also can be high risk, because they cut people all the time now. It's not like in the old days where you started working for a company and you stayed with them for 40 years. That's not the case anymore. And so, you know, they have hiring and firing, and so people, even in these quote-unquote big companies, over a 15-year period, could be at three different companies. So more lately, the students have been wanting to pick these up. So we currently have 17 companies that are in operation right now. Some of them doing better than others. And with that original investor, I've started about, I don't know, 14 of the 17 with that one person. We've done that, or 12 of the 17, something like that. And that's what we do. And so I think it sort of grew this way. It wasn't like I woke up one morning and said, this is what we're going to do.
Okay. So if I understand you correctly, it sounds like really it happened quite organically. And there was this convergence of you filing patents, having experience, you know, seeing very little liquidity from the licensing, and then this investor approaching you, and it really sort of grew from there in combination with a change in the interests of the students that you were working with overall.
Yeah, all of that was happening at the same time, right? And you know, I've always filed a lot of disclosures. I know that, so I've been at Rice 26 years. I've been a professor for 37 years. I've been at Rice 26 years. And I've kept, Rice keeps the recording of all this. In 26 years, we have filed, on average, one disclosure a month for the last 26 years, which means that, you know, some of those disclosures, sometimes get bunched together, but that's a lot of patents. That's a lot of disclosures. I think the university has, it's over 20% of Rice University's intellectual property has come out of my laboratory. So we're really quite active here, and I'm certainly not 20% of the faculty here. I'm one out of something like 900 faculty. Yes, that's sort of how it happened. It kind of evolved that way.
So if I can take us back for a moment to that investor that you've been working with who initially approached you, how did they hear about you? What is a little bit of their story?
Well, so he doesn't read the basic literature, but I think he was reading in some trade magazine. What I've always done for many years is I've learned to work with the public affairs office press releases. That we have a publication, we think it's something of interest, we'll try to get it out in trade journals and magazines and things like that. And that you could do by working with the public affairs office at the university. Now, some professors, they don't want to bother. I actually intentionally bother with this. I do this. And the reason I do this is it gets the word out much more broadly than the tiny little nano community that reads your articles. And it's really, really a boutique that actually read the articles. And the ones to really read it in detail are really only the graduate students that have to read it in detail to either report on it in some group meeting or to take some of the ideas and run with them. So we've always tried to get things out in the trade journals and in magazines and things like that. And I presume he read it. I never really asked him, but I presume he read it somewhere like that. And these were graphene quantum dots. He had an interest in this new material, graphene. And so he reached out to me. And this was like December of 2014. I replied back, and we met by Skype. That's back when Skype was more common. And then we visited, we had a meeting with each other. I was in the city, not far from him. So he drove up with one of his co-investors, and then we started going one after another, and it set up a whole different precedent. And what I had known from the first company that I had done back in 1999 is it took an enormous amount of time. And here I wasn't having to give nearly as much. I could continue being a professor without the big confusion. If you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, send me an email, tour@drjamestour.org, and we will get together and I will share with you about why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus.
So, you know, it's funny. It sounds like you understood very quickly that in order to broaden the reach of people that you could get the word out to, it was really about relying on the expertise of the public affairs office to essentially do marketing for you. And that's, I remember part of how I initially learned about your research was I was reading phys.org, which, you know, it's a journal for science news. And I was looking at, I was going down this rabbit hole because I was working with a mining equipment manufacturer that cared a lot about sustainability. And we were in the process of doing a transaction to get them a carbon accounting solution. And ended up on this rabbit hole where I was thinking about how to redesign their business model because I also have consulting in my background, and found your research and thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Dug into the scientific articles, did my own economic analysis really broadly, and was like, this changes the game fundamentally, because a lot of the problem that we traditionally see with recycling is the economics of it. It's not that it's not feasible, it's just that it's too expensive quite often to make it work. So I'm curious then, when it comes to the commercialization aspect, why did you and this investor decide to go public versus private? Or if it's only been that a few companies have gone public, maybe talk me through some of the strategy on how some of the companies have launched.
I don't get much involved on the business side. Sometimes, I do, but in general, I don't. So he actually, he wants, if you don't take a company public fairly quickly, I mean, you can go 20 years and a materials company, actually, on average, a materials company takes 8 years to start selling material. That's a long time to wait. And that's on average. So you can easily go 10 years. And one of the first companies that we started was Weebit. It was actually the second company that we started. We started under another name. And they make resistive memory, this ReRAM, resistive random access memory. And they just started selling, really, this past year. They just started selling, and so now they have contracts with three companies and expanding at that. And that's memory. It turns out it's very good for AI as well, and so that's expanding their markets. But that we started in 2015, so it was a 10-year run before they started selling. It's very hard to break into the silicon market. So what he does is he takes these things public rather rapidly, usually through a reverse merger. A few years ago, something called SPACs were very large, where you would take this special purpose, you'd take sort of a failed company and just take their spot on the stock exchange. A reverse merger is sort of like that, but the original company still stays around, but they're generally not. They might not be doing that well in some cases. So you come in and do that. And what that allows you to do, you open up the funding to the public market. So rather than going the VC route, and actually we've never gone the VC route in any of these companies that we've started. We've never had any VC money. VCs, as you know, they have a high return on investment that they like because they have a diverse portfolio and the number of companies that are really going to make big money is generally small. Now, the top VC firms, they have more of a selection process. They're self-selecting for the better ones. But in any case, it often doesn't work out as well for the initial investors when a VC comes in. If you go to the public markets, that's another way to make money. Now, in the U.S., we have a lot of possible money you can get through these private sources. In other countries, you don't. And so they're more attuned to taking things to the public and raising the money that way. And so that was the way that these companies started raising money, was through the public markets. So it can bring to the investors money more quickly. And I think that that's what his motivation was, because what he likes to do is start these companies, he'll infuse, I don't know exactly what the number is, say $500,000 to $1 million himself, and to bring a few others of his friends along with him. That'll get it running. Then they'll take it, within about 2 years, they'll take it public through a reverse merger, and you start getting public money and you can start building this up more rapidly. And you often there's a hold there. You can't sell your stock right away, but after 2 years, you can start selling. And if it's done fairly well, you can start to withdraw what your initial investment was. If your initial investment was $500,000 or $1 million, now you've got that back in hand, and then you can go on to the next deal with that while this first one starts growing. And so you can kind of pull some money out in that way. So it allows you to do that much more quickly than if you had done the traditional VC route. So I think that that's why he has done that. And in every case, I've just run right alongside him. In the cases where he wanted to keep something private and wait more years before they take it public, you know, I've just done whatever he does. And when he says he's gonna sell 15% of his stock, I sell 15% of my stock. I just what I learned because I'm not a quote unquote money guy. You follow what rich people do. Do what rich people do. I took this class. On this financial university or something, some Christian teacher, I forgot what his name was, but he said, do what rich people do. Rich people don't rent furniture, you know, and so when you do what rich people do, it's probably a wiser thing. So I just follow his lead.
Okay, that makes sense. So it sounds like the intuition here was really around how quickly can we get certain companies to market, and that's why we'd rather take them public versus go the VC path. And then also for you, it allowed you to have access to almost this kind of financial mentorship to be able to make what you felt were wiser decisions, kind of piggyback off of good, what you felt was good decision making.
Yeah. And plus these guys really respected me. They respected the fact that I wanted to still be a professor. I had worked, we never took VC money in my first company in 1999, but I had talked with a lot of them. I mean, they want you to leave your job in the university, go 100% into this, or they want you to mortgage your house and get quote unquote skin in the game and these sort of things. And so now they're not all like that, but I'm just telling you, I've met many like that. And these investors really respected me, and they realized the best place for me is to leave me in my lab and come up with the next big thing and the next big thing. And so, and at the end of the day, a lot of time when you go with VCs, the inventors don't make a whole lot of money. And in this way, I could get some founder stock, and that ran right alongside, and they protected me. You know, these money guys, they can really drive your equity to nothing. They have all these clever ways of manipulating things, having capital calls, and they know you can't keep up with it, and then you get driven really small. He protected me. And I think that what that did is it caused a lot of trust, and so it allowed him to make money, it allowed me to make money, and because he wasn't just thinking of this deal, he was thinking of the next and the next and the next that we would come up with. And so he had a lot to do with it. And he, even to this day, he drives me faster than I would like. In other words, you know, he hears about this technology in my lab. Let's start a company around this. It's not ready. It's not ready. You know, we have to develop. Well, you know, we'll just start a company and then you develop it. He actually pushes me. And I think it's good for everybody to be pushed a little bit.
That makes a lot of sense. And actually, it answers one of my initial questions, which was, what allowed you, after having this experience where, you know, you had gone the licensing route, you had seen that you'd honestly made quite a little bit of money, not really much in terms of liquidity, and then you'd had this failed experience of trying to run a company, trying to sit on a board to trust this investor. And it sounds like it was that he knew how to recognize what your priorities fundamentally are and to respect what you're good at without forcing you to make these huge changes, take on risk that you weren't comfortable with, and also while protecting your equity so that you didn't experience dilution.
That's right. He did that. He did that. And he continues to do that. And the other thing is, he sheltered me from the investors. In other words, investors love to call you up, hey, you know, let's go have lunch. And you sit across, oh, when are we going to start selling? How's it? And he protects me from that. So they go through him. And so he'll say, okay, this is a really important investor. We'll bring him to your office. So I don't have to go out and do these dog and pony shows with all of these folks all over. At one point, I just did one. That's it. And that's because I declined. They said, you know, would you come to Australia and do this show with us? I said, I'm not going to Australia. That's too far away. So what they did, he didn't do it, but one of the CEOs went to my wife and said, you know, we'll fly you and your husband business class, all expenses paid, to Australia. You'll have a great time. And so they went through my wife, and that's what forced me to have to go to Australia. But in general, he really respects my time, and he understands I can be a hothead. He understands that, and he's a very calm guy, and so he bears with me.
Okay. No, thank you for sharing that. So I am curious then, so you've mentioned a lot about the relationship that you have with him and how he's really respected you, shielded you from investors, shielded you from some of their either sometimes predatory or kind of crazy acts, and really just, you know, creates a safe space for you to focus on the work while also pushing you and motivating you positively. I'm curious, how do you feel that when it comes to the students who are going on to launch these companies, who are going on to really take on the risk of launching their own innovations that you know that they're protected?
It's a good question. You know, when they take this on, I don't look at their contracts. I don't look at things. I just tell them, be sure you get this. Be sure you get your healthcare. Be sure they get you this and this and this, and that your equity, your stock is going to vest over time, and you get these sort of things. And so I have to entrust them to these investors as well. You know, I think sometimes the CEOs, I'm thinking in one company in particular, didn't treat one guy very well. And I was very concerned about that. And I spoke to this investor friend of mine. I said, here's what they did to him. And I really love my students. They're like children to me. And when they're not treated well, it really hurts me. And I felt that this guy had been taken advantage of by the CEO, that he was promised certain stock, he was never really given, and things like that. And so I think they learned from that too, that they're going to have to watch out for these guys if they want to be able to hire my students into these companies, because my students can really save them years of needing to learn some of these things. It's still working together, and he has to keep a better eye on the CEO, make sure that they're treating my students well. I mean, sometimes my students might be the CEO, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're CTO or their chief science officer, something like that. And we want to make sure they're treated well. And if they're not, I tell them, oh, this is not good what they're doing to you. This is not good at all. You should just tell them you're going to leave the company. I mean, I think I care more about my students than I do about the company, because they're like my children. And I think that they sometimes went into this because they trusted me. And so that's why it's important that we treat them well.
No, I completely understand and agree. And this answers a different question I had, which was around how these relationships bear out over time. Because I think what often happens, and what I've been hearing at some of the most recent sustainable finance conferences, where, you know, people who are bankers and investors, they're thinking really critically about what is it that is going to enable the sustainable transition to happen. And I often feel as though it comes back to relationships, and it often comes back to getting away from this short-term pressure that the markets have on us, and really think and build over the long term, and take this view, not just of history and of money, but of how can we make sure that what we invest in and where we allocate our assets is going to be something that builds the community long term, reinvests in the relationships, because at the end of the day, that's the most important thing.
Yes. Yeah, that's certainly the case. The relationship is everything. And then he brings people along with him to co-invest, and people make money. And so when these companies do well, there's people that know that this came out of my lab, and they're ready to invest in the next big thing that we come up with. So they don't all work out, but there's enough probability that it's going to work. And yes, it's a relationship, and when there's trust, it matters a lot. It really matters a lot when there's trust there. It still has to be a good deal. You want to get a good deal with these people, but there's a level of trust in what makes sense. And you need to think about the technology, like, you know, this metallium, this MTM that Flash Metals USA, this we took public through the Australian market. That's a mining country. I mean, that's what they do. They do mining. And so they had a lot of expertise in this. You know, others, we might not go in that direction. Like, we have this new AI chip design, this new device design. Australia has like zero presence in AI, whereas the U.S. has an enormous presence in AI. And lots and lots of money flowing, hundreds of billions of dollars are flowing all the time for AI. So you know, we still think about the business sense as well. There's something here. And there's the nice thing about the U.S. also is that we have very tight laws, and CEOs can't mess around very much or they go to jail, and it's good to have tight laws, and what people do with the money, and so there are advantages. So there's things like this that I think about as well. But yes, relationship is a key for us.
So then I am curious a little bit around the friction point in the relationship. So you mentioned at the talk that you gave at Northwestern recently, actually, for Graphene with the Universal Matter Company, that you could create this kind of artificial price of about $3,000 for graphene. And you mentioned then in one of your lab meetings that they didn't necessarily go for that when you offered this idea and they decided to go a different path. Could you maybe talk to me a little bit more about that story how you navigated that?
You really misunderstood what I said. It was your misunderstanding. So let me clarify what happened. So I don't know what they're selling graphene for right now. I don't know what the price is, but it's probably somewhere, say $60,000 a ton is what it was. When we first started this work, it was up around $120,000 a ton or even higher than that. So I just said, okay, maybe $60 a ton. Maybe it's less than that now because they're making a ton a day of this stuff now. They have the capability to do that. So I wanted to say, how much does this new process, how much does it cost us to do this new process? So if you have PFAS, per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances on activated granulated carbon, then the granulated activated carbon, if you have it on there, and then you convert that carbon into graphene, all the PFAS turns into calcium fluoride. All the fluoride goes to calcium fluoride. What would this process cost us? Well, if at the end of the day we could sell the graphene for $60,000 a ton, then we're going to be making a lot of money on this process. But I said, let's artificially, let's artificially lower that to $3,000 a ton to bring it in line to where a bulk plastic is sold, somewhere around $3,000 a ton. If I did that, I'd be making $1,900 a ton on this process. That's all I meant. I never brought to them to say, go for this at $3,000 a ton, nor would they ever go for it. I don't expect them to go for it, because I don't know what their internal costs are. I'm just saying the electricity cost is not the major cost. There's a lot of other costs for them. So I was just artificially doing this, but it's not something I presented to them. And there was no friction based on that. No friction based on that. There may have been friction based on other things where I think they should go in one direction and they want to go another direction. That's fine. That's normal stuff. And I leave it to them. They're the business guys. They just stay out of my lab and I'll stay out of your company. And we'll do it. But that's like with all of them. I let them run the business. I give them my views and then it stops there. But I think you misunderstood what I was saying.
Okay. That's fair. And I think in any case, I appreciate the clarification because, it's important to have that, right, so that I'm not misunderstanding things. I think then where my question was really trying to drive towards is what happens when there are moments where, you're the scientific advisor and you're answering questions or you have an idea and they say no. And it sounds like, you sort of let bygones be bygones. You respect their expertise, they respect yours, and you just focus on your lab in those situations.
Yeah, I mean, and there's things. I mean, I'll give you an example. Universal Matter was the first to license from us flash Joule heating, and it was for making graphene. Then I had offered to them, I said, hey, we learned we can make carbon nanotubes by flash Joule heating. And they didn't respond to it. They didn't show any interest in this. So I licensed it to another company. They made that decision, and so I licensed it to another company. And so I offered it to them. And I also offered to them the separation of metals from waste, everything that's in metallium. I offered it to them. And they looked at it, they studied it, and they said, that's not for them. I said, okay. And I walked out and I started another company around this. So you know, they made that decision. And there's been other times where I've suggested to people what they might want to do, but they're business people. They make their decisions, and I don't get involved in the day-to-day of their business. So it's easy for me to throw out advice. It's sort of like being an armchair quarterback. I don't know the stats on any of these guys on the field. I don't know what they run the 40-yard dash, and I don't know what their, you know, what their ability is to catch a ball or anything. But it's very easy for me to, when some coach is having some trouble in a game, why didn't you listen to me? If you'd only listened to me, you'd have been. So it's very easy to play this armchair quarterback. And I realize that. So I'll give them my advice. And when they don't want it, I walk away. And I'll give my advice again. And when they don't want it, I walk away. But once they've turned me down 3 or 4 or 5 times, I get the picture. Okay, these guys really don't. And so then I just go away. And it's up to them. And I say, well, you know, just send me the check in the mail.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me laugh all the way to the bank, right?
Yeah.
So I think then, so in the last sort of 15 minutes or so that we have, I'm curious if we can maybe look towards the future a bit. So do you have any perhaps long-term hopes around the strategies that companies forming out of your lab might pursue when it comes to beating out competition in the market and thinking beyond just making the technology cheaper than existing models, for example?
Yeah, I mean, every company is so different. You know, I have these ones that are purifying soil, pulling out metals, making graphene, making nanotubes, grabbing hydrogen, making silicon carbide. Every one of these is different. I can tell you is the same thing I tell them, is that the faster you can get to market, the better. I mean, and it doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, we know from Microsoft Word, you can sell something. It doesn't have to be perfect. And Microsoft Word, I'll assure you, is much better than it used to be. We used to have crashes all the time. I mean, to crash a couple times a day was sort of normal. And if one thing bound up, the whole Microsoft Word crashed. Now you can have one thing hang up and you can stop that, and it doesn't affect all the other things you're working on in the Microsoft Windows package. You know, the whole Windows package. I mean, it's so much better than it was, but they sold it for you know, 2 decades, this trouble. So it doesn't have to be perfect. If you can come in at 10 times lower price than what other people are coming in at, you can have a pretty good run here. So that's what I want to look at. But I also am looking at, you know, and I've learned this over the years, is what's the best locale to start this company in? Is it best to start this in the United States? If the CEO is in another country, is it best to then start it in another country, or should we just search for a CEO that wants it in the best place for it? I mean, so I look at these things now, and I give my advice to the investors, and I've gotten to the point, it's become so painful teaching CEOs the technology, and sometimes they never really get it. They never really get it. That's, you know, like, we had one that was on the medical side, and the CEO had no medical background. He had no technical background. And every week I was talking with him, trying to teach him this stuff, and he'd get it for like a few days. And then I'd have to go over. And I said, look, for these next companies, I want an engineer or a scientist right there. I want them to be in business, but you know, say a bachelor's degree in engineering, and then have gotten an MBA and had a background in this. I saw Elon Musk say how important it was in his companies to have the leadership be engineers. And I see the same sort of thing. When the leadership does not have a background in that area, it just makes it really hard for them to just get it, to really understand it. And then any investor can just yank them around, because investors keep trying to tell companies what to do. And that's a dangerous place when investors are telling you what to do because they really don't understand the technology. They don't understand how it can have an impact. So, you know, I urge them, just listen, at least listen to what I have to say here because I think you're going down the wrong road. And there have been many occasions where I thought they were making the wrong decision and I knew they were. And it took them a couple years to say, yeah, that was the wrong choice. So for example, if you're going to treat a certain type of cancer with our little molecular machines, there's some types of cancers that this would be good for. There's other types it would not be good for. And they go after the one that's not good for. And they told me, well, this big investor, you know, someone in his family had this, so he wanted to go after this. I said, that is the worst decision. That is the worst decision. You might make him happy, but you're going to bury the company in the process because this won't solve that type of cancer. And how do I know that? Because I'm the one who developed this stuff. I know how it works. There's these sort of decisions. And when there's a CEO in there that doesn't have the medical background to understand why I'm saying what I'm saying, he'll just go with what this investor wants. And it's at that point, you know, they don't want to listen. You just walk away and you just know what's going to happen. I just know what's going to happen. So in those cases, I just wish they'd listen to me.
Because of you, millions of people have heard the gospel.
If you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he's risen from the dead, and you will be saved.
That's right.
That's the requirement.
We talk about science concepts which draw people in.
Take these nanomachines and have them drill into cells.
It'd be a great way to kill cancer, right?
We also talk about Jesus Christ, who's the best in everything.
My faith in Jesus Christ means more to me than anything.
If you could continue to give or give for the first time, we would certainly appreciate it. You can go to jesusandscience.org/donate. All U.S. donations are tax deductible. Thank you so much.
Well, because the critical thing that it sounds like you're trying to drive home here and what you've just said is that the fact that you are an engineer allows you to exercise discernment, to be able to understand what the potential applications actually are versus what they are not. And understanding those limitations is really critical for the long-term viability of the company, for the long-term viability of the technology, rather than just making some decision because an investor told you so and that investor has no idea what they're talking about.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And I mean, look, you can get domain experienced people that really know what they're talking about. But to just go on the whims of an investor, it's problematic. And I'm really trying to drive them toward an early success. I'm looking at what is the low-hanging fruit here. How can we make this work as an early success? That's what I'm looking at. And, you know, I've been in this business a long time. And when the technologies come out of my own lab and we've written papers around this, it really takes about 10 years for me to become really fluent in a field. That's why when people contact me, hey, I got a great idea. You know, I'll give you a piece of it. We'll develop it together. I'm like, there's no way. I mean, you're asking me to commit a 10-year part of my life. And you can only do that so many times. And at my age, I don't have too many decade segments left to be doing this. And so it's got to mean something to these people to say, you know, what are my thoughts on this? And when I'm emphatic, that is wrong. That should not be done. I hope they take heed. And in the cases where they haven't, I think that they paid the price.
That makes sense. So then I guess coming briefly back to the investor that you work with and the respect that you named earlier that he shows you towards the science while also pushing you, where do you feel he adds expertise while also staying in his lane?
Yeah, he's purely a business guy. He knows how to move companies around, how to buy them, how to sell them, how to do these sorts of things. And he has the very high level view. He doesn't know the details. And he'll tell you that. He doesn't know the details. But he's a visionary. And I mean, he's got these big grand views. And that's what he adds. But you've got to get a CEO in there that really understands the area. And there's been times that I've been concerned that the CEOs, they just need to go. And I'll tell them. And he's such a nice guy, it's hard for him to cut them loose. So those are some of the decisions that need to be taken place. And so you waste a lot of time when you have the wrong person in there. You know, not all of our companies have succeeded. In every case that I can think back on, in every case, it's not been the technology, it's been the management. You have to have three things. You have to have management, you have to have technology, and you have to have money. Usually, if the management is right, you can get the money when there's good technology behind it. But when the management, any one of those, it's a three-legged stool. Any one of those three, it doesn't work out. This stool is falling down. And in every one of the cases, it's always been the management was not right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the great conundrum, I think, that I've seen personally working often with large manufacturing companies that have really brilliant technical people is that often the reason that things are not going well is it's not the technology, it's the people. And it's bringing people along. It's making sure that you have the right people there in the first place, but also that communication. I mean, this is what my undergraduate degree was in, you know, is like people come together in pursuit of a common goal, but, you know, it's actually the pursuit of that common goal and the ways that they self-organize or don't, or how they treat each other or don't. That's what creates the problem for the long-term viability of the organization itself.
Yeah, that's true.
So I am curious, when it comes to how you think about where we are now and zooming out a bit here. So we have many of the emerging technologies that are coming out of labs like yours. And then we also have these really large legacy, capital infrastructure projects, factories, companies. What are some of your hopes when you think about the large scale transition that we need to make when it comes to sustainability? And how do you think we'll get there?
Yeah, so sustainability is a really hot issue. You know, you look at last December, CO2 was like the most dangerous thing. It was going to kill off humanity. By January of 2025, CO2 was an innocuous gas that wasn't hurting anybody. So you have a political party change, and everything changes. And everybody that was doing CO2 capture, CO2 conversion, is out of business now. I mean, they don't want to renew their grants. Things change. So, if you want to do something with sustainability, sometimes you have to have sustained funding. And when there's not sustained funding, you don't have sustainability. I'm not taking a stand on CO2. I'm just using that as an example. Although I do have concerns about CO2. In my mind, CO2 is God's sink. That is where carbon ends up, CO2. To bring CO2 back to any usable material, you have to break these carbon-oxygen bonds, which are very strong, and you got to put in about 200 kilojoules per mole per carbon-oxygen bond, and almost double that is what you got to put in because of the efficiencies. So I don't think it makes good physical sense to ever bring CO2 back to a usable compound. If you're worried about it, you can store it down whole. But I don't think that the whole conversion thing is a really wisely thought out thing. The problem is there was such a thrust behind that on the sustainability that as a scientist, I would be laughed at if I came too strongly with these arguments. The community laughs at you. So that's the danger. You want to do sustainability, it has to make thermodynamic sense. I'll give you another example. 20 years ago, they had this big push for corn ethanol. We're going to take corn, we're going to make it into ethanol, and we're going to put that in gasoline. We had done the calculations in our carbon center here. If you tilled the ground, planted the corn, watered it, all on ethanol running machines, would you have any ethanol at the end of the day? And the answer was no. It just didn't make sense. And we told venture capitalists, you're wasting your money going in for this corn ethanol. And they all lost their money. that you can't fight the thermodynamics of the science. And so, yeah, if you want to trap CO2, fine. But to try to convert the CO2 into something useful, I mean, I just saw a talk yesterday. They're taking electricity, converting it into light, light converting it into converting the CO2 into carbon monoxide that you can use as a syngas. And you know, I just confronted him with, what are the thermodynamics of that? You're taking electricity. That electricity you're getting from the burning of methane anyway. And even if you were to get that electricity from a sustainable source, that should then be supplementing the grid. It made no sense to do the conversion that you're doing. So if you want to have a wise, sustainable environment, a research effort, you have to think through the thermodynamics. And you say, well, scientists have looked at this. This is what they say. Yeah, the very same scientists that are going to be making their money, getting their grant money from this. You have to have dispassionate scientists looking at this. Those that don't have some dog in this fight. To really look at the numbers and to say, this just doesn't make sense. I just don't see it. This just doesn't make sense. The whole direct air capture, we're going to pull CO2 directly out of the air. I am not sure that that really makes sense, certainly not on the systems that we have. By the time you look at all the CO2 that you made to build that direct air capture system, it's very, very hard to see this making money. And that's why they want to put it up in Iceland, where they can get this energy that from this ground. And so it's just hard to think about this. So that's what you should do first. You're going to have to only deal with very, very big numbers. Really, if you want to stop the CO2 problem, you got to stop creating the CO2. You got to allow nuclear to come in. Nuclear will deal with a lot of this, but people don't want nuclear. And they say the wind and solar can do it. Well, they can't do it yet. You can't build enough solar panels to do this, and they don't stand up well when there's a hailstorm. I mean, everything is broken. So there's a lot of big issues that you have to think about. Elon Musk is very big on these big solar arrays and making electricity that way. He's a very smart guy. You don't bet against Elon Musk. I'm just saying I'd love to see more about the numbers and how robust these solar arrays are, where you have, you know, 1,000 football fields covered with this stuff, and how much do you generate? It's very hard to compete with a 14-inch hole in the ground through which oil and gas just comes pouring out. Your footprint is 14 inches as opposed to miles and miles and miles of these solar panels that cost a lot of money and a lot of energy to make. So you need to think about it in that way. If we're going to do something sustainable, but we do have a form of energy right now, and that's nuclear. Wind just doesn't cut it. I mean, look at Germany. Germany went hot all on wind and solar, and now they're buying this natural gas from Russia and from other places. They just about buried their economy. Europe is paying so much more for energy than we are paying. And it makes it very hard for them to manufacture and compete with us now, because they blew this energy thing. They didn't get it right. So, and then what do you do with these wind turbines when they're done of their lifetime? You bury them whole. It's an environmental disaster. What do you do with these big solar arrays at the end of their lifetime? It's an environmental disaster. So you have to think really holistically about this and get dispassionate people, scientists, to really look at some of these numbers, because a lot of times it just doesn't work.
No, that's fair. I mean, so what you're saying essentially, and you've invoked a lot of the issues, right? There's the circularity piece, there's the energy consumption piece to even be able to get the energy from renewables in the first place. There's also then the economics piece, which is what I spend a lot of my time thinking about, because the carbon markets are in a precarious place when it comes to the current administration, the current geopolitical situation. And there are a lot of people who have diverse, you know, solutions, ideas, but it really comes down to what is their vested interest, right? And I think that that's what you're driving back to. I am curious, because it is invoked in some of the research that your lab is doing, what are some of your thoughts on the energy storage piece? There's a lot being said around the potential for solid state batteries and trying to figure out just battery storage more broadly to solve some of these challenges. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so volume-wise, you cannot beat nuclear. You just can't. And nuclear will run all day, and at the end of the day, you have something about this big is your, something about the size of a large pill is the waste from that day. And so you bury that under a mountain or something. And so rather than blowing out huge amounts of CO2 into the air. On the other, now if you move to hydrocarbon, you can put so much more energy density in a liquid hydrocarbon per volume than you can in a battery. I mean, so much more. It just doesn't even compare. Batteries are very heavy. So for static systems, big arrays of batteries for static systems, maybe that's all right. It's really hard to beat oil for that. It's a shame that we burn oil. It's much better to burn natural gas. There are other ways of dealing with the natural gas without emitting so much CO2. And these things have been figured out. It's just a matter of implementing them. So in other words, you can take the methane, you strip the hydrogens off, you get two moles of H2, and you convert the carbon to a carbon solid. Then you can take that carbon solid and turn it into flash graphene and turn it into building materials that way. It doesn't enter the carbon cycle, at least it won't for hundreds of years, which is all you have to store it, because in hundreds of years we'll have different energy sources. So you don't have to be emitting the CO2. What happens is when you do combustion, it's over 800 kilojoules per mole of energy you get out by combustion, whereas if you do it converting it to carbon solid plus hydrogen, and then burning and then using that hydrogen in a fuel cell, mixing it with oxygen, that those two reactions combined are about 400 kilojoules per mole. So it's about half the amount of energy out when you don't blow out CO2, but the efficiency can be much higher. So in the wash, it's about the same. So there are ways. What I'm saying is there are ways to use hydrocarbon fuel without blowing out CO2. This is not my idea. Every oil company now is working on this because on the next administration, they may be hit with the CO2 problem again, and they should have something ready to solve this. So there are ways of dealing with it today. We can solve this today. It's just that you don't want to kill an entire economy in doing it. So you have to have that transition in a way that would allow you to transition to those sorts of energies soon. The whole waste footprint, I mean, if we can learn to use our waste, and that's a lot of what we do in my lab, we take carbon waste, we turn it into graphene or nanotubes or some other building material. We're learning how to take old concrete and make it into new cement and concrete. Learning how to do that type of thing, taking old electronics, e-waste, and pulling the metals out rather than more and more and more mining. So there are numbers that can look very good on that. And so there's a lot of small steps that have to be taken to address these sort of things. But you really have to look at the numbers. What are the numbers here? How much does it cost? Mining costs a lot of money. And right now, everything that's mined in Australia gets shipped up to China for processing.
And that's without the social risk of being, having to go into indigenous lands and the,
political risk, yeah. And people are fighting wars over resources. More wars have been fought over resources than over ideologies. So you fight over resources like oil, water, minerals. And that's what we concern ourselves with. So if you're not straddled with that, then you don't have to fight wars. If you can really desalinate water cheaply, you don't have to fight wars over this. If you can pull rare earth elements out of electronic waste, you don't have to fight wars over this. So there's good reason to be able to do this. If you have some energy sources where you're not dependent on foreign oil, You don't have to fight wars over this thing. So, yeah, there's a lot of reasons to live sustainably, and that's what we try to do. But I think we have to look at it rationally as well.
Absolutely. I think we are at the end of our time, so I'm going to close us here. But I just wanted to thank you again for being willing to have this conversation. I mean, and also, you know, once again, for giving me the opportunity to join your lab. I think it's been really informative. It's been very validating as somebody who's coming more from the business finance side, who's seen the need to have some of that engineering discernment. And I appreciate your perspective, because I think you're right. The thermodynamics is a truth that we all have to honor and live by, and understanding how we then invest and how we allocate our resources is going to be a critical part of the economy in the future. And I feel like, you know, trying to convince people of that and trying to also then make it viable from the technology perspective is one of the critical things at the points in the supply chain and in the system where it's most impactful. So. Yes. Thank you, because I think the work that you're doing, I know, is really, really trying to tackle the problem at its source, rather than just be yet another Band-Aid solution that we then have to push onto the next generation.
Indeed. Okay. Well, thank you, Kimani. And
thank you.
Maybe in a few years we'll do this again and see. You know, we'll just sit here and count money together.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. Hopefully. But I think in the meantime, you know, holding on to the purpose and the meaning of the work, that's what drives me.
Thank you for joining me today. If you could give us a like, share, or podcast review, we would appreciate it. If you have any questions, you could send them to ask@jesusandscience.org, and we'll try to answer some of those questions in an upcoming video. And if you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you want to hear about why I believe, send me an email to tour@drjamestour.org, and we'll get together by Zoom, and I'll share with you why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus Christ.